This is Colourful Radio.
Hi, David, are you there?
I'm fine, Julianne. How are you?
I'm good, and I'm sorry if I keep calling you that. You've been, like, around us for so many years that I'm just so used to saying, Rodigan, like, I know you.
Yeah, I mean, people do, funnily enough, call me Rodigan, and sometimes when they meet me in person, they say it, and then they sort of say, oh, sorry, it's David, isn't it?
You know? Yeah, or Mr.
But I think just because over the years, you know, the surname has been associated with the music, and people tend to you know, refer to me as Rodigan rather than David, but which is fine by me. I mean, most of the old jingles that I had were Radigan and Raddy and all that sort of
Raddy,
stuff.
So. Raddy Adobwise, Maddy.
Exactly. that really does date you. Actually, it doesn't, because I'm still using it. So
oh, you do? That's good, because every time I kept saying that in the office, everyone was killing themselves laughing, because saying every time I think of him, I just remember that jingle.
It was a very famous jingle. I can be walking down a street in Jamaica, and if somebody recognises me, virtually the first thing they'll say is, Raddy, yeah, Dubwise, Smutty. It became, really became a catchphrase in the 80s because of the work I did with Barry Gordon in Jamaica and in England, of course, on my old Saturday night show in the 80s up into the 90s. So, yeah, it's a bit of a tag that's always been there, really.
And it's quite funny you saying that from the 80s into the 90s, because on air I tend to, like, not mention age-wise whatsoever. And it's at times like this, when I'm talking to somebody like you, you're right, it does kind of show my age when I'm going back and remembering, because, yeah, I used to listen to that Saturday night show.
Yeah, but you were very young then, Julian. You were only about 7.
Even younger, I think, David, even younger. I could barely learn to turn the radio on. I think my mum had to do it for me. Before we come up to date, I have to ask you a little bit about your past, because I tell you, I could sit and talk to you for ages. I'd love to go through your photo albums. I'd love to hear all your stories that you've got to tell, because you must have some serious amount of stories. All right, but first up, you went quiet when I said that.
I do, I guess, but... you're right, we could be here all, you know,
yeah,
all night.
I would love to do that. Well, first let me start, go back to what enticed you actually into reggae music in the first place.
Well, there was a television show called Ready, Steady, Go, and there was a girl called Millie, and she sang a song called My Boy Lollipop. Mm. And I saw her singing it, and I was smitten with the sound of this crazy backbeat, and I discovered quickly that it was called ska. Well, it was also referred to as blue beat. And from that I discovered Prince Buster, the Scatterlights, the Wailers, and this crazy, energetic beat from Jamaica called ska. And that was it. I was completely hooked. And that was 64, 65, 66. By the summer of 67, I was avidly collecting the records from the West Indies on the Island record label and those early record labels of Black Blue Cat and Pyramid and so on, and then eventually Trojan, and really just rolled on from there. I was a 16-year-old schoolboy in the summer of 67, and 007 by Desmond Dekker was the biggest tune of that year for me. And that's where I caught the fever, really, and I continued avidly to collect the music. So through school and into college and so on, I was a record collector. I was a fan. I still am. I still go to record shops and listen and buy. Nothing's really changed. The music has changed a lot over the years, but my fascination for it hasn't. And that's really where it started.
Well, you're saying that you were an avid fan. I think you went further than being a fan. You could have got a doctorate in it, because is this true what they're saying about, not only did you learn about the genre, but you knew about every artiste and rhythm track as well?
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, that just came from my fascination. So I was living in a small village in Oxfordshire, and I would study record labels, you know, intensely, and I would note things that I picked up from record labels, like B. Lee. Was that Byron Lee or Bunny Lee? And then I found out that it was Bunny Lee, or there was also Byron Lee, who was because there was no internet then, and there was no press as such. I mean, if you were lucky, you got occasionally something in Sounds or, you know, one of the music press, but nothing more than that, really. If there was an article in the press, I used to cut it out and keep it, you know. So I gleaned most of my information from listening to the records, identifying the sounds, the way records are produced. I realized after a while that certain sounds seem to indicate a certain producer or a certain studio. And I began to identify that as the years ticked away. It became more and more apparent. And it was just that, really. It was just train spotting, you know, just listening. Mm. And then eventually I went to Jamaica and I was able to, you know, meet, when I began broadcasting, I was able to meet a lot of the stars whose work I had admired. Mm-hmm. And I was then able to confirm what I kind of knew. But really, any record collector will be able to tell you a lot.
Yeah.
Because any serious record collector gleans and learns from listening to the music. And that's the way. And I think that's the most because I was a fan, I bought these records and I listened to them again and again. And, you know, there weren't, you know, 28 television stations then. There was BBC One and ITV, and then eventually BBC Two. There were no pirate radio. There was no Freedom stations. There was no internet. It was a very different world.
Mm.
And records were a tremendous currency. They, you know, you would meet and share record information with friends and go to clubs, and friends would come back from the West Indies with white labels, and, you know, it was all that, and word of mouth. And that was where it all started from. That's how I learned. I learned by listening. And because I bought those records, you know, I can more or less tell you, you know, without even thinking when and where I bought most of the records I have in my record collection.
Really? And you must have a vast collection.
I do, yeah. But because they were all very important to me, you know, yeah. The Treasure Isle records, the Channel One records, the Studio One records, you know, and so on and so forth. And I saved hard to buy those records, the albums, the singles, and so on. And they became very important to me, and they always will be, because there's something absolutely unique in those recordings, and I'm afraid that they do not in any way compare to the most of the music that's made today, because they're simply tremendously superior to most of the music, in my opinion, that's made today. Because basically what they do today is copy what was done 20, 30 years ago, and frankly, they don't do it as well.
Oh, never do when they copy, do they?
No, and I mean, that's not to say that everything that's being made today isn't exciting. I mean, there are, of course, exciting things being made today, but just as a rule, just generally speaking, I'm afraid, sad to say, that with the advent of technology, everything's been dumbed down, so one man can literally build a whole rhythm section, and my gosh, it does sound like that sometimes. It's inhuman. There's something missing. You know, when the Soul Vendors were at Studio One, and you heard them say, one, two, and they hit those drums, and then the horns blazed in, and the guitar and the bass, and then Alton Ellis started to sing, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. You know, you went weak. You just, there was something about the acoustic recordings, the fusion, the electricity, the engineer, the way it was all mic'd up. I could go on and on. I won't shut up now. But
No. It's great listening. Because, you know what, there are some new artists that are coming out now that are hoping that they're going to stay around for a while, not necessarily in reggae music. They're actually saying that they're liking the feel of going into the studio and just hitting it one time with the band there and making and doing the cut just like that. But they're few and far between, as you say.
I mean, look, I want to know, where's the new Luciano? Where's the new Dennis Brown? Where's the new Gregory Isaacs? I don't mean sound-alikes. I mean people who are as original and as exciting as those artists are still and were, obviously, in their prime. You know, where's... Well, I better stop because I may sound too critical.
You're in the position.
I can only be honest. Again.
Yes, then you can say these things because, like you said, you've been around. You know the genre back to front.
Mm.
So you are in a position where you can actually say, where are these people?
Mm. Well, I really want to know where they are in Jamaica. And the British reggae scene, of course, is on its knees.
Mm.
Sadly, there's hardly anything. There's actually been more reggae being made in Germany and Switzerland and Italy than there is in England.
Yes, which is quite a shame.
It's very sad, but there you have it.
Well, I want to go back a little bit again, if that's okay. I just wanted to find out, you know, when you first started playing out in the dances, what was the reaction to you when you first went in there?
A stunning silence.
Really?
The first gig I ever did in London was at the Apollo Club in Willesden. And it was 1979, and I walked on stage. Place was packed to the rafters, and the MC introduced me, and from the cheers and screams and hollows, there was a deafening silence. And literally hundreds and hundreds of black people just stood there staring at me as if to say, no.
Oh, you should have had... Oh, that would have been a good one on video.
It was priceless. But when I spoke and played a little jingle and played my first record, they cheered, and it was, you know, I was on a roll from then, really. I mean, because I'd been broadcasting for about a year and a half before I did that first London gig, I think that people who'd come to see me knew that, you know, I wasn't hitching my horse. Well, maybe people thought I was hitching my horse to a bandwagon, but you can't fool people for very long. You can get so far in life with a smile and a shoe shine, but after 10 minutes, you better know something. And, you know, people who care about reggae, black people, whatever race, color they are, people who care about it, whether they come from the West Indies, whether they come from, you know, India, China, Jamaica, wherever, this is a universal music. And obviously there was an indigenous black community, and this obviously in this city of London, who cared passionately about the music that we now call reggae. And they listened to my show on Sunday lunchtime, and they obviously they could tell that I was genuine, because I am. I always have been. I you know, I didn't sort of use this music to, you know, further my career. Do you know what I mean? Inverted commas. My career was an accident. I didn't plan to be a radio DJ. It just happened. I was invited to do an audition for Reggae Time, and it just... actually, somebody else wrote the letter on my behalf. I didn't write the letter asking for the audition. I was a record collector, and someone wrote a letter, and I got a reply from BBC Radio London saying, come to this audition, and I laughed. I said, "Who?" And my girlfriend at the time said, "Well, I wrote the letter on your behalf. I think you should go." And I said, "Oh, that'd be ridiculous, you know." She said, "No, you should." And I did. And well, I got the job. That was in 78.
As they say, the rest is history.
I guess so. Yeah, I guess so.
And I'm so glad you did, because, as I said, I'm showing my age. Don't care. I'm going to show it now, because, you know, when I let my brothers hear that I was interviewing you, they're going to be like gobsmacked, which is really great, because you actually helped a lot more people listen to reggae music than would have listened to it, if that makes sense.
Well, thank you very much. I mean, I've always believed that as a broadcaster, you're duty bound, without sounding patronizing, to share your passion. And if it means that someone's just hopping down the dial and they happen to land on your show, hopefully they'll like what they hear. And if there's a brief, without being tiresome, explanation as to, or background, or something that's informative without being tedious about the music you're playing, then that helps people perhaps who are not familiar with it to understand it. And that's what I always try to do, to confirm information that people who were passionate about the music already knew, to inform if people who didn't know and who wanted to know. And at the end of the day, ultimately, to entertain by sharing what I believe to be the best of what was available. And I've always tried, as much as I can, to reflect various aspects of reggae music, because it's a broad spectrum, from lover's rock to dancehall to Studio One to Treasure, etc. I mean, there are various types of reggae. And I've always tried to reflect what is happening in the marketplace now, and then, you know, occasionally drop in one or two oldies as sort of background sketches. And that may encourage people to search further. And we've seen the results of that in Europe, in Germany, in Switzerland, in Italy, in Sweden, where there is now this phenomenal interest in reggae music. It's unbelievable what is happening. You know, every major city in Germany, and every town and every major town and city in the whole of Italy now literally has sound system crews and teams cutting dub plates, flying to Jamaica.
Excellent.
I'm not exaggerating. This is the reality in France as well. This is the power of the music from one island in the Caribbean. It's truly remarkable.
You can hear the passion when you talk about it as well. I love that. You don't get tired of doing them, the face-offs?
Well, I'm not... No, I mean, as long as the people who are taking part, with a good heart.
Yeah, because sorry to cut you, because I was going to say that. I heard that there was an occasion once where you was at a clash and somebody disrespected your wife, and you stopped the clash, didn't you? Is that a true story?
Well, I what I said was, yeah, I mean, I put them in their place.
And then you
and moved on.
Good.
And it was in America, in Connecticut.
Good.
And I put them in their place, and the crowd responded accordingly. And I don't think that particular sound will ever try anything like that again.
Good. I was real proud when I heard you did that. I said, good.
Thank you.
Because sometimes they go too far, and it's not about that.
No, it's unnecessary, uncalled for, and it destroys the majesty of the music, and I think that's very sad when it does that.
Right. Well, you know what? In the words of Bob Marley, I've got so much things to say right now, and I would love to sit and hear all your stories, and as I said, go for your picture album, but I know I can't keep you on here for too long. David Rodigan, legend as you are, thank you very much for coming on.
You're very kind. Thank you very much indeed. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye.
This is Colourful Radio.